Hello, hello, hello. This is Cortina Jackson, and you are listening to What's on Cortina Jackson's Mind. You know, I love doing podcasts because it really affords me the opportunity to talk with the most extraordinary people. Tonight is no exception because I have the privilege of talking with quite an extraordinary man, Mr. Billy Graham. How are you, sir?
Wonderful. And yeah.
Thanks
for inviting me to be a part of your podcast.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. I'm just so honored. And first of all, I want to say, of course, thank you for your service. I tell you, as an African-American woman, I sincerely thank you for what you have done, how you've paved the way, what you must have endured, and, you know, just the pride I feel being in your presence. It really is, I'm telling you, it is quite an honor, sir. Now, you are a Vietnam vet.
Yes.
You flew two tours over Vietnam in 1967.
Yes.
And you retired as Lieutenant Colonel after 24 years of service in the Army.
Yes.
Wow.
You dreamed of doing this even as a child. And so I would really love for you to tell us about your childhood and what it was like growing up in Arcadia, Louisiana.
Yeah, I'll be glad to. Of course, Arcadia, Louisiana is a small town, and I was born and reared there with two parents, a mom and dad. They both were teachers, but my father was also a farmer. So, you know, we raised our cattle, and we had crops. So, you know, we ate very, very well. We ate the most healthiest food. I guess they would call it organic now.
But
everything he did was, we didn't really know that we were poor because we had everything. They made sure they provided for us. I'm the youngest of three children, well, four really. I had one sister who died in infancy and a brother who has now passed, but I have an older sister and a brother. But we were all teachers. I came from a teaching family. And of course, being the black sheep of the family, I chose not to teach. And because, you know, I guess at the age of eight, my uncle gave me a pair of binoculars. And with those binoculars, I would lie back and look at the clouds and wonder what it would feel like to touch a cloud. Mm-hmm. And that was a boyhood dream for me that I wanted to fly. And of course, coming from Arcadia with no aviation experience and so forth, how would that be possible? But I'm here to tell you, with God, all things are possible.
Yes.
All you need to do is have a dream. Mm-hmm. And if that dream is in line with God, God will place people in your path to make your dreams come true. So let me just tell my story a bit. I always had that dream, like I said, from a young child, and how God placed people in my path. I had a math instructor when I was in high school. He just passed a couple of weeks ago. He was teaching at Southern University, Dr. Gibson. But he was a wonderful math instructor. And of course, we had to all go to college, my sister and brothers, we all had to go to college, you know, once we graduated. But anyway, that was probably one of the first people in my path, because I chose to major in mathematics because I felt like that was my best subject. Now, not knowing that was be a requirement when I took my flight test after graduation, graduating from college. I went to college with the Southern University, A&M College in the university in Baton Rouge, where I majored in math. And upon graduation, I was commissioned a second lieutenant. So I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Army.
Wow.
And I chose a corps in the Army that they had aviation, because that was the main focus. Of course, transportation, you know, you have ground transportation, you have air, you have road, and you have water. So I wanted to fly in the air. So after being commissioned, I went to Fort Eustis, Virginia. And the most amazing thing was that I was the first of two people to arrive at Fort Eustis. The other guy was named Jerry Darnell. He was from Connecticut, had gone to an Ivy League school, and he had his private pilot's license. So he of course, he's more fortunate than I. We just happened to get together, and that was just the other person that God placed in my path.
Wow.
He told me, he said, Billy, he said, I'm going to take my flight test. And you're not doing anything sitting around, and classes haven't started. So you can ride with me down and take my flight test. And I said, sure, I'll go with you. And when we went for him to take his flight test, he suggested, well, why don't you take your flight test? And, I can say I always had this dream of flying. And I said, well, I don't know. Well, going to, actually, Crawford was a segregated high school. Southern was predominantly black university. And I kind of felt like he was coming from an Ivy League school that, he had, a heads up on me.
Right.
So I was kind of reluctant. He said, oh, go ahead and take it. It's not going to hurt or anything. But Jerry Darnell took the test, and I think Jerry scored about 110. I think you needed about 80 to pass.
Wow.
I scored 105. And at that point, I got that rush that this dream I had been having could come true.
Wow.
So we went to our first basic course class. And of course, they called Jerry out of class and said, hey, you did wonderful scores on your flight test, and we're going to send you to Fort Rucker, Alabama to flight school. So he came back in and told me, he said, man, Washington called and said, I'm going to flight school. And I said, that's great. And all of a sudden, they called me out of class a couple of hours later. And of course, it was Washington calling saying, hey, you did really great on your flight test. He said, would you like to go to flight school? Quite naturally, oh, yes, indeed. Wow, this is actually, and like I said, a rush kept coming on to me that I could realize this boyhood dream I had. So anyway, when I went back and told Jerry about it, and he said, well, look, I'm going to fixed wing school. He already had his private pilot's license, so he knew much about flying. And I said, gosh, that's great. He said, well, look, you tell them, they're probably going to want you to fly a helicopter. You tell them you want to fly fixed wing aircraft, because I'm going to fixed wing school. And so when I went back to let him know that give them my decision, told him, I said, well, I would love to go if I could get fixed wing. So they said, well, we'll call you back in a minute. We'll see. So they did call back and say, okay, you're going to fixed wing flight school, Fort Rucker, Alabama also. So once we finished our basic course, then of course we went to flight school in Fort Rucker, Alabama. So again, like I said, that dream was coming to a conclusion, to a reality. Okay. Now, when we got into flight school, of course, Jerry being, an individual, he was the first to solo in the class. And once he soloed, they tear your shirt. And let you know, okay, that's your first mission. First thing is that you solo. Well, one day after he soloed, I was really having a hard time with my instructor. And of course, seemed like my instructor, I could never do anything right for him. I got into flight school, and I definitely didn't want to wash out. You make one mistake and you're out. So that same day, Mr. George Kopp, I never shall forget him. I kept saying, Mr. Kopp, what am I doing wrong? Why are you not pleased with my flying? And he just kept saying, do this maneuver over, do this maneuver over. And of course, it was just really concerning to me why he keep insisting. So finally, he told me, he said, you land this aircraft. And I told him, I said, Mr. Cobb, what am I doing? I said, I just want to make sure that I, do what you want me to do. He said, pull it over on the grass and let me get out. And I figured I'd washed out of flight school. So after that, he told me, he stated that, now you go out there and you give me 3 takeoff and landings and come back, which means I would solo. And I said, oh, Mr. Copper, I'm not ready to solo. He said, yes, I wouldn't be letting you loosen this aircraft, you know, for you to kill yourself. Now go out there and give me through. You're a great pilot. So I went out and of course I soloed. I was about the fifth solo in the class. And I was the only black in the class. And it was like about 34 members of that black class. So I really was overjoyed the fact that, you know, these things were happening, that my this boyhood dream was becoming a reality.
Yeah.
So after we graduated, I got my wings, I was pinned, and of course, Vietnam was right at our door. So I went to Fort Lewis, Washington, where we formed up an aircraft company, and we deployed to Vietnam. That started really into my aviation career as a pilot flying in Vietnam. And one of my first missions, they try to put you on simple missions first when you arrive in Vietnam. My first mission was to escort supply ships and tankers up the Saigon River into Saigon. Well, when the ships came into the South China Sea, they came to a coastal city called Vung Tau, where the Saigon River emptied into the South China Sea. So my mission was to escort those ships from Vung Tau all the way up the Saigon River into Saigon, which is now called Ho Chi Minh City. It was about a 4-hour mission. As far as any kind of action, mainly the NVA and VC, as the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, would try to sink those ships in the Saigon River. And okay, on my aircraft, I had like 4.5 rockets. And that was mainly to break the contact from them firing on the ship. And where I could call for artillery or an airstrike or whatever. So my main mission was to break the contact from them firing on the ship. We had naval gunship patrol boats in the Saigon River, which I could call and let them know what was happening. We had destroyers lying out into South China Sea that they had these big guns that could reach any place the area I was in. I could call in an airstrike. I could call in field artillery based upon what was the closest battery to me. I had all the frequencies to the ships or to the aircraft or to the artillery batteries to get their artillery support to stop the Viet Cong or the NVA from attacking those ships. So that was really my first mission, I'd say mission in Vietnam. I later went on to support the 18th Army Division, that's the Republic of Vietnam Division troops, as they were being inserted into the jungle. And of course, that was another mission that required me to provide air cover, especially when the helicopters would be bringing the troops. You know, you'd have quite a few helicopters with the troops on board, and they had to land in what they call these landing zones that were really B-52 craters. The B-52 bombers had bombed those areas. And of course, a helicopter is very vulnerable when it's trying to land or take off. That's the most vulnerable time. So I wanted to make sure, and that's when you talk about being precise and on time, I was always make sure that I was over that landing zone and I would loiter until those helicopters come in. As they were coming in to offload the troops, of course, in the tree line, you had the enemy who would try to shoot the helicopters down as they were landing.
Wow.
They have to flat or land or when they were taking off. That's the most vulnerable time. But what I would do, like I said, I had rockets. I could fire rockets into the tree line to break the contact so the helicopters could land, offload the troops, and take off. So, you know, like I said, it was very, very critically important mission. And anytime those troops were out there, if they came under attack, Again, like I said, I had all these radio frequencies, whether it was from destroyers, whether it was from artillery batteries, or even airstrikes. You know, at that point, and that's an awesome responsibility they give a young man, to be able to call those batteries in, authenticate, because you had to authenticate them, you know, who you want to know, and then adjust the artillery on targets.
Wow.
Times I wanted to make sure that, you know, as those rounds were coming in or whatever, you know, the airstrikes, we had to make sure we marked where our on the ground. That required, like I said, white phosphorus rounds, high explosive rounds from those rockets to make sure that our friendly units were not hit with the artillery. And those guns from the ships, like I said, they could fire those big guns, and of course, I would fly just above the gun target line. That means that once they would meet, there's an elevation that those rounds would come in. In fact, they were so large you could actually see them, you know, as they through the air. And I would make sure that they would give me the max the max altitude that those rounds would be coming. So as I would watch them as they would fire them from those guns, I would watch those rounds come up, and I flew just above those rounds to make sure that I would put them on target. Wow. Once I got them on target, we'd say fire for effect, and of course they were just really offload. But the main thing was protecting the friendly troops. So you know, it gave you a sense of responsibility, a sense of duty, that the fact that you didn't want to ever be late because someone's life depended on what your actions. So those were some trying times, but some very, very important times for a young person coming out of Arcadia, a population about 3,000.
Gosh.
But and then being, you know, deployed on the other side of the world, that you know, is just unbelievable.
Wow.
Yes, indeed. I did have an opportunity to, I flew combat missions, I flew combat support missions, and combat service support missions also. So I was selected because of my flying ability to fly with the MACV flight detachment, military assistance to Vietnam, which meant that I had an opportunity to fly our commanders, that General Westmoreland, General Abrams, who when they were the MACV commanders.
Wow.
I happened to have an opportunity to fly with our ambassador, who was Elwood Bunker, and his staff. And of course, like I said, many times being the only Black, you know, I mainly served in units, you know, 10 years before I flew with another Black pilot.
Wow.
You had to make sure you did everything and you did it right. Absolutely.
Yes.
And after my first tour, I was transitioned into another aircraft, a more sophisticated aircraft called the Obi-Wan Mohawk. And I was a spy in the sky. Mohawk has a lot of electronic gear on board. Side-looking airborne radar, which you can fly in one location, and you're looking and tracking what's going on in hundreds and hundreds of miles away from you. It had infrared also. Infrared detects the difference in temperature. And many times, like in Vietnam, you have triple canopy jungle, which you cannot see below all of the vegetation. But that infrared would pick it up and it just give you an image. If it's warmer than the surrounding, it would give you an image. So that way, many times when they were coming, you know, the NVA were coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail or something like that, you could pick it up. You could actually see them as if, you know, it's just a negative copy is what it would print out.
Right.
And had photography on board that aircraft also. And I was fortunate enough to go and fly two tours in Europe also with the OV-1 Mohawk, where we flew against then the Russians and the East Germans when they weren't our allies.
And wow.
By flying the borders. And of course, with that aircraft came more sophistication. You know, we had the inertial navigational systems, which mainly all of the commercial aircraft use now to navigate, much like when we have in our GPS.
Okay.
On our phones and so forth. But, you know, we had that, you know, many, many, many years ago. And this is back in the 70s and 60s when we had this kind of sophistication.
Wow.
GPS in our phones and, like I said, in our cars and everything else. The aircraft. And that was to keep us from spamming across the border, because many times the Russians and East Germans, well, they would head for the border hoping you would cross so they could shoot you down.
Oh, but wow.
We had controllers. Like I said, we had the inertial nav systems on the aircraft, but we had what we call ground controllers who would watch us, monitor us on radar to make sure we wouldn't cross the border. But yeah, we flew missions, like I said, against the Russians and the East Germans before they became our allies.
Oh my goodness.
And I ended up commanding the unit, being the only African-American pilot there, but also the commander. Like I said, you know, in order to get to those positions, you know, you have to make sure you do everything right and by the book.
Yes.
You know, there was no room for error. No, you didn't make any mistake. You couldn't afford to make a mistake because you were gone.
Wow. Yes. Now tell me this. That being said, of course, you have to be on your P's and Q's. Did you experience some of the racism, some of the discrimination that I'm sure was pretty prevalent during those times and on those bases? Of course, there was racism back home in America, but while you guys are out fighting and you know, the camaraderie, did you feel that? Or yeah. Did you? Yeah, tell us about that.
Now, my flight mates, my classmates, they embraced me. There was some racism. In fact, there was one individual, he was of Jewish descent.
Hmm.
He got washed out. Of course, during this time, you know, blacks and Jews were pretty close together, especially down south. But they washed him out. I didn't see any racism because, like I said, I just tried to make sure I did everything right. I studied. I could not go to Panama City, you know, which Fort Rucker is close to Panama City, to the beaches, because it was segregated during that time. So when they would go to the beaches, I stayed home and studied. So that was one thing. But when we would fly, when we went into our instrument phase in flight school, I often flew into various airports, and we would have breakfast or lunch at those airport diners. And many times, you know, I realized the fact that, you know, I would always tell them, I'd say, okay, guys, we came here together, we're going to leave together. We kind of joked about it.
Right.
But, you know, people, they didn't, because I was in uniform. And during that time, you probably remember that many times when service members were traveling, you know, their relatives would tell them to wear their uniform because they felt like they would not really bother them much or harm them. They knew they were in uniform. But I was in my uniform at these diners and so forth, and I could see many of the employees looking out the window in the kitchen, wanting to say, hey, you know, there's a black guy out there eating, you know. The whole rest of them. But one, it's kind of a funny story. It was like five of us eating, and they went out there and they only saw five aircraft. So, you know, some of the white employees went back and said, hey, you know, that boy flying one of them airplanes. And they said, wow. No, I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
Oh, wow.
So, anyway, as I went to the restroom, as we were, you know, going through the cashier to pay for our breakfast and lunch, this one cashier stated that I'm going to find out. So as I came up to the counter, she said, boy, are you flying one of them aircraft? And I said, yes, ma'am.
Wow.
Oh, come on. No, you're not really flying it. Yes, ma'am, I am. And so anyway, as I was leaving out, she thought I was gone. She rushed back and said, hey, let's go out here and watch this N-word kill himself.
Oh.
But anyway, as we took off, you know, it didn't shake me at all.
Yes.
I told the other guys, I said, look, I said, we'll take off in formation and I'll stay down, you know, until the end of the runway, and then I'll come up and join you. I wanted to put on the little demonstration board and let them see this black guy flying this aircraft.
So, wow. Anyway,
and so, as we took off together, we lifted off, but I stayed low just over the end of the runway as they climbed on up into the air. And then I made a wing over, came up and joined them. I let them see the fact that, hey, we could do it also.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
You just have to know how you handle situations like that.
Yes.
So you couldn't get angry and do anything that would just, you know, kill your chances of making it, of doing it.
That's
so
right.
Many times you have to, you know, do what's best.
And yes.
You use your head. You have to think at all times, you know, what's the best situation versus reacting to various situations. And I also got my commercial license and during my transition period also.
Wow.
So I got my commercial license in 1970 because that was the other dream I had of flying commercially. You know, those things happened at a pretty young age for me. And, you know, 70 years, 1970, a bit while ago, but
yeah.
The other thing I wanted to do was get out of service and fly commercially. So every time I would want to get out, well, flight school put on a 3-year obligation because at that time it cost like $125,000 just to train one pilot.
Wow.
And it costs about $6 million. So
no.
You're an obligation to make sure they get their money's worth out of you.
Oh, but yes.
3-year obligation after I completed flight school. So after my 3 years were up, I'd gone to Vietnam and was thinking, well, I got all this time. I wanted to go and fly commercially. When I wanted to get out, they sent me back to Vietnam for my second tour.
Oh.
So I was like, I'm taking this equal opportunity thing too far. But I had to go back and serve that 2-year tour. But one thing that happened, the reason I stayed in for that 24 and a half years, is that every time I decided to get out, they would either give me a promotion or an assignment that I really wanted.
I see.
And like I said, I ended up going to Europe. And of course, over there, you know, I've seen more country than I have really states in the United States. I went to about 35 different, flew into about 35 different countries throughout Europe and so forth, you know, in Southeast Asia and so forth. So it's an education, travel is an education in itself.
Yes.
Even in Vietnam, we flew about 125, I know I'm jumping back and forth. Each time you flew 125 hours a month, they gave you what they call R&R, rest and relaxation.
Uh-huh.
Whether you go stay in country or they sent you to another country. I ended up going to Hong Kong and like Australia, Malaysia, Bangkok, Thailand, and also as a test pilot. I was a test pilot also. Anytime you remove a major component off an aircraft, like a wing or an engine or a landing gear, it has to be test flown before it can give it back to the regular pilot.
Oh.
That gave me an opportunity to go to some of these other places where they were refurbishing or repairing these aircraft to test fly them and then come back. So that was like another rest and relaxation where I had a chance to go and see, like I said, many, many different countries. Like it was an education. So I really enjoyed being in the military. It afforded me some wonderful opportunities. When I had my family in Europe, you know, having an opportunity to go to the Louvre and all throughout Italy and France, and you know, it's just like I say, it was an education. My kids really enjoyed it. Having the chance to go to Spain and, like I said, to go to Venice and these places that you never dreamed.
Exactly.
And, you know, it was all happened because of me being in the military.
Oh gosh! Oh, how lovely! Yes. It really is. So we get to live this through you because sometimes these different places, we have a limited view on the world. You know, it's kind of hard when you're in a box and you only, you know, you don't get out. And so,
absolutely.
Yeah, the being in the military really does afford a lot of vast experience and knowledge. It really increases your knowledge.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh. And so, okay, tell me this. When you were over there doing these different missions, were you ever injured? I know things were a little testy, a little scary for you. My goodness, but did you have any situations where you did get into a little bit?
I had my baptismal fire, but you know, many times the bases that we was staying on, And we mainly, because of aircraft, had to fly off a fixed installation. But we would receive mortar rounds. They would try to hit the base and so forth. Excuse me. So, you know, we received, we'd get the alert from the sirens and so forth. We'd run to the bunkers and everything. My baptismal fire came that while I was out reconning my area, I saw what looked like a tank that had been destroyed. Hmm. It was sitting out in the middle of nowhere. And one thing that you know, you wanted to make sure you always sharpen your aiming and shooting skills. And I saw this tank, and I was getting ready to go back to my base. I said, well, let me expand my rocket. So I called the unit and asked the permission to go ahead and expand those rockets, because I wanted to make sure I was always honing my aim and mm-hmm. firing at with these rockets. So I didn't really take much precaution to think that it was active. I just thought it was just one that was inactive. So my first run on it, my round came out above the tank, and I said, So I went around again and I came back in, and the second round went just below the tank, but some of the shrapnel hit the tank and I could see the sparks. I said, oh, I'm getting closer now. Hmm. So that third time I got really low and slow, coming in to make sure I hit that tank, and all of a sudden they opened up with a gun on that tank. And my heart went into my throat. Because they were firing back at me. And of course, now, if you notice, we fire red tracers. Mm-hmm. The enemy fired green tracers. And when those green tracers coming up, that's like walking those rounds to you. You know, it's like a light.
Oh, gosh.
It really, like I said, my heart went into my throat. I could barely breathe. I went back and told them, I said, I'd received my first baptism of fire. They all laughed. But yeah, we had some close calls. You know, aircraft hits and so forth. And of course, many times, if an aircraft took a hit in the wing and so forth, we had self-sealing tanks, which means they had to remove that tank. So it gave me an opportunity to maybe go to Thailand to test my aircraft after replacing the tank and so forth, the fuel tank.
And, gosh.
Yeah, but, like I said, when we said we'll support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and bear true faith and allegiance to the same, you don't take that light.
Right.
You put yourself in harm's way to do your mission.
Gosh.
And I guess the sad part about it while I was over there was many times when they hit those bases with mortars and so forth, they had aircraft that would bring those bodies in those body bags back to Central Identification Lab in Hawaii. Times we'd be on the tarmac ready to take off, and those aircraft getting ready to take all those bodies. That was a somber part of it to see. And of course, we lost over 50,000 soldiers.
Oh, gosh.
And that's what's on the Vietnam Wall. I lost several of them from Arcadia.
Oh, really?
Right. And many of my friends, fraternity brothers from college and so forth, friends I flew with and everything else, they're all on that wall. So, like I said, it's a humbling, it's a somber type thing you have to go through.
Yes.
That's all part of being a soldier.
Yes, yes, indeed. Oh, gosh. And then you mentioned earlier being one of the only black pilots for quite a while. Did you at the time, did you realize this as, did you say to yourself, wow, this is really something that I am one of the only black pilots, or were you just focused that I am a pilot?
Mainly that's it. I just wanted to do it right. And like I said, many of the guys and we're still friends, we still communicate with each other. Some come by and we stop and have lunch and dinner together. Some used to come, you know, to my home when I was in Dallas, and you know, I had a little swimming pool out there and everything else. But you know, we would always visit, no matter what. And like I said, we still maintain that friendship. Yeah. But many of them, I just don't really recall of any very negative things happening.
Yes.
Like I said, I was a pilot. We were all pilots. That's and like I said, they embraced me as their commander. As long as I had those green tabs on my shoulder, you know, and I gave them, you know, directions and so forth, I didn't have any problem with that. Now, they may have done it, you know, behind my back. I don't know.
Right.
It never appeared that, you know, I was getting any overt racism from the guys I was flying with.
That's just beautiful. That is beautiful. Now, do you get to fly any now? Have you kind of got out there, or have you stayed on the ground a little bit?
You know, Vietnam brought on a lot of health issues. You know, they were using Agent Orange to defoliate the jungle and all of that vegetation over there. And I was finding that stuff every day for 2 tours.
Wow.
And it took a toll on me. And like I said, some of the things that, you know, those who served in Vietnam are suffering from. Mm. I'm just glad that at least that, you know, that they're trying to give people, many of them, assistance with their health issues.
Yes.
I have some health issues from being in there. I saw where they were talking about some chemical spray that's used around the yards, and they got all of these lawsuits in and so forth.
Yes.
That drone was not tested before they put it in there. And we should have known the fact that with that stuff killing trees and all that heavy vegetation so
quick,
and breathing that inhaling all of those fumes, you know, while we're flying, that it had to be doing something to us. But we never thought about it. Never really thought about it until, you know, later on when you start going through a lot of problems.
Yes.
You know, many of the soldiers had suffered from prostate cancer, diabetes, and you know, that's something that Agent Orange, you know, you take your Agent Orange physical and some compensation for it now. Right. But you got to let the people know. And that's one thing I try to tell all our veterans. I'm a member of the American Legion Post 593 here in Grambling. And we try to get the word out to all the veterans who either served in Vietnam or Iraq and so forth, that they need to go and be checked.
Yes.
You know, many of the times they may be suffering from the results of Agent Orange.
Yeah.
The oil fields over there in Iraq and so forth, you know, inhaling and all of that. Just like, much like, you know, the people in 9/11, you know, they found a passage of that where they're going to continue to get some support, you know, rather than trying to cut them off and say it's expensive. But, you know, when you doing a service, whether you're a first responder, whether you're a military man or whatever, when you're out there trying to serve your country, your country should be able to come to your aid also.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm glad you're able to kind of be that person there where you are to educate those who may not know where to go for that type of assistance.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, at the end, I definitely want to for you to give contact information, because I'm sure there are a lot of veterans or even family members who would love to know more, or maybe absolutely experiencing something health-wise, and they may not know or realize that. Yeah, right. Yeah. So during your time, you very well deserved, received many honors and medals and accolades. Tell us about some of those honors that you received and what do they mean? What was the meaning behind the different ones?
Okay. Well, I guess the you mentioned about the Bronze Star. I received Bronze Star twice with V device for valor while serving in Vietnam. I received numerous air medals. You got an air medal every 100 hours. So anyway, I got about 23 or 30 of those air medals based upon that. Probably about 30 or more air medals. Meritorious Service Medals. Army Accommodation Medals, Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry with V device, which means for valor. Those who were awarded as we had our service. I have probably more than 30, medals that, you put on your, you place on your uniform, along with my aviation, senior aviation badge as being a senior aviator.
Yes.
But,
wow.
Yeah.
Quite a few. Your list is long, and I was just, wow. I was just thinking, as I was going through the different honors and things that you've done, it was just very inspiring knowing the work, the things that you had been through. I was completely honored and inspired by those things. One of those was one received from the Tuskegee Airmen Association.
Yes. I aviation service medal. Milton Pitts Crenshaw graduated from Philander Smith in Arkansas, and he was one of the Tuskegee Airmen. He was the operations officer. He taught Daniel Chaffee James, which became the first Black four-star general in the Air Force. He taught him how to fly. Benjamin O. Davis Jr., who was commander of the Tuskegee Airmen, he taught him how to fly. Well, about 2015, I was honored to be called up to Philander Smith on his 96th birthday, I believe, in celebration. So when I was honored to be a, we're standing on those guys' shoulders.
Yes.
Red Tails and so forth, and what they did in World War II.
Right.
So they gave me the aviation service medal for my service in Vietnam, but it was just an honor being there to honor him. Now, he and Mr. Wright, who later, after World War II, were flight instructors at Fort Rucker. I never had a chance to fly with Mr. Crenshaw. Uh-huh. But I did have a chance to fly with Mr. Wright when I was in flight school. And like I said, he's a Tuskegee Airman. So, my heart was just pounding and pumping. And the fact that, I'm sitting here, now you're talking about
man.
Gave all the honor and praise. Yes, indeed. And the thing you mentioned about upcoming events, I received a call last week from Philander Smith. They're going to be celebrating Mr. Milton Crenshaw's 100th birthday.
Oh my gosh.
They asked if I would come up there and be a part of that. So I told him, I'm really glad to be there. Of course, he's passed on. But just the fact that just to honor him during World War II. Those guys were so great in things they had to endure. Let us know the fact that, hey, they had to endure more than we did,
Yes.
And of course, they were so victorious. They never lost when they were escorting those bombers. They never lost a bomber. They didn't want them to get that glory of being able to do it, but they couldn't keep it from them. Brave individual to get out there and show the fact that, when people were saying what you can't do, you can't fly and everything else, to prove them wrong.
That's right.
No one put a limit on your how you can go, your potential. Only you can do that. And I'm looking forward to November the 9th is when they're having his 100th birthday celebration of being up there in Little Rock, Arkansas, and help celebrate his 100th birthday.
Oh, that's going to be outstanding. That's going to be so neat.
Absolutely.
So tell us, what are you doing now? I know you work in the church. So what do you do now?
Well, we just came out of our annual conference in the church. I'm the adult Sunday school teacher, which I really enjoy doing that at our church. I'm the lay leader for our church. I'm a trustee for the fourth region, which is on our church, Methodist Church, we have the local church, and then we have the district, Monroe District, and then the region, which covers all of the districts and so forth. But I'm a trustee with the fourth region. So, you know, that's an honor to be selected for that. I'm with the American Legion Post 593, and I'm the social concerns officer there. And in fact, we just helped celebrate a lady who is in a nursing home here in Ruston, her 104th birthday.
Right. My goodness.
Right. So we try to stay in the community also. We're trying to inspire and help others. I've been on speaking engagements where I mainly like to talk to the youth and tell them, you know, you can achieve it. If you can believe it, you can achieve it.
Yes. You
know, those are the words, the things we need to get out to all our young folks, because they have greater opportunities now, and don't waste those opportunities. Go for it. And one thing about a dream, a dream don't start with you. A dream starts with God. And if you keep having that same dream over and over and over and over, God's trying to tell you to go for it. And that's what you have to do. You know, if you're within God's will, He's going to make a way. Like I said, God placed many, many people in my path to make for me to realize my dream. He did.
Yes.
And, you know, you got to have a strong faith in God. You got to have a belief. You got to have a belief in yourself, in your community, in your parents, in your church. Those things are very, very important. That's your values. You got to have a value system. And you know, those are the things you use to go forward. Well,
yeah.
all things with God, all things are possible.
Oh, I just love to hear that. Inspired. Everyone's gonna get something. I'm so glad that you said that, because sometimes, you know, it's those little things. I work in a position where, with some young people who had never heard that they could do it or that they could make it. You would be surprised, the people who have a dream, they want to sing, or they want to write, or they want to, and they, instead of thinking of what they want to do, they think of everything in between. How do I get there? I don't have the money. The odds are stacked against me. My parents don't support my dreams. But I love, you know, how even in what you did, you put God first, and you didn't have to worry about how am I going to be a pilot someday. God laid the way. Just
laid the way.
Oh, yes. I believe in that so much.
And you know, and I try to reflect on the things that happened to me, even though back during the, you know, the 50s and 60s, when, like I said, we were under segregation and everything else. Even that, God still allow you, you know, to realize your dream.
Yes.
In Him. Have the faith to believe in Him and His darling Son, Jesus Christ, with the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, that anything is possible.
Oh, thank you, Lord. Oh, that's beautiful. Oh, thank you for that. Thank you for encouraging even me with that. Okay, so you do speaking engagements.
Yes.
How can people get a hold of you if they would like for you to come and speak?
Well, I have an email address. I love to give you that.
And yes.
It's like bgraham2211@yahoo.com.
Okay.
You can contact me through that. I have a cell phone, and that's 318-265-2211.
Wonderful.
And, you know, please feel free to do so. I love to do it. And especially when you're going to inspire, you know, someone to go for it.
And
believe in themselves. And like I said, don't let anyone put a limit on your, you know, how high you can go. You know, you're the only one can do that, you know, because God has given us all an opportunity. And if you, like I said, if you keep having those dreams over and over and over, God's saying, go for it. You can realize that dream.
Beautiful. Yes, sir. And you truly reached for the stars. Took your plane up there and touched the clouds.
Touched the clouds. And you know, there are some poems that were written about touching the face of God. When you go up, you can touch the face of God.
Oh,
my goodness, I tell you.
Wow, good. So to God be the glory.
Many times that, you know, like I said, being from a little small town like Arcadia, that I was in Vietnam, like I said, on the other side of the world. Where do we don't even have the North Star. You have to navigate by the Southern Cross.
Wow.
And even though you get lonely, you get homesick and everything else, but you can climb up in that aircraft and in that air and meditate. And like I said, just I found myself many times just doing that. And meditate. You know, just like when you're driving in your car, you can meditate. You know, you don't have to always be in your closet. You know,
right.
You can always meditate on God anywhere. Oh. Just take that time and do it and just let Him know.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, it's just been absolutely fascinating. I really took such a joy in hearing from you, and I know so many other people are really going to enjoy this. You know, I don't get to talk to anybody about these things that are just so important in our history.
Yes.
And you are just a fantastic man, and that I'm extremely proud of. You've made me very proud. You've Thank made you. A lot of people very, very proud, sir.
Thank you so much. Absolutely.
It's a blessing to
Thank know. You for allowing me to, like I said, to share some of the things that, you know, that I had an opportunity to live.
Yes, yes.
Thank
Absolutely.
You for doing the podcast, and hopefully that, like I said, it would be an inspiration. And, you know, that's about changing the world. If you can touch one person.
Yes.
You have changed the world. Absolutely.
Beautiful. Beautifully said. Man. Well, we are going to end this tonight. We're definitely going to have you back, because I'm sure you have tons of stories for us. So, yes indeed. So we're going to end the broadcast now, and we look forward to seeing you again. And in November, we know you'll be in Arkansas. So
absolutely.
We look forward to seeing you in all your future endeavors.
Well, thank you so much.
Yes.
And I think you've already you had Reverend Donald Ciccone Wills.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he was my pastor for 16 years.
Get out of here.
Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed. So I just really admire him also. Reverend Wills, that's like going from elementary school to high school and 4 years of college, all under his tutelage.
Wow. You're surrounded by some great people. Him, Mr. Melvin Lars.
Just, oh, yeah.
Boy, I tell you, that is a room full of...
Absolutely. And now to have you add to that, I just feel so privileged and honored. Oh. I tell you, absolutely.
Thank you so much, sir. Well, for those listening, as usual, you can follow me on my website at www.cortinajackson.com. You can follow me on all my social media. I'm on Facebook at On Earth As It Is In Hell. I'm also on Instagram at MissTina_TheWriter, MissTina_TheWriter. Gosh, have I listed them all? I think so. LinkedIn, Cortina Jackson. However you follow me, because now you know it's on my mind. And I thank you all for listening to what it was on Mr. Graham's mind. Just a wonderful mind indeed. So thank you all, and God bless. And good night to you, sir. God bless you.
Good night, and God bless you all.
Yes. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.